This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey everybody, it's Jessica, and today we're bringing you a different type of episode. This is a recording of my conversation with retired Justice Stephen Breyer. This is part of a conversation that I had with Justice Breyer for Live Talks Los Angeles, and Justice Breyer was on his book tour. I was thrilled and honored to be one of the many people who's been able to interview him about his new book, Reading the Constitution, Why I Chose Pragmatism, Not Textualism. This book is all about Justice Breyer's argument that when it comes to big questions of constitutional interpretation, it's better not just to look at what the words in the Constitution meant at the time that they were drafted, but to do more than that, to take into account questions like history and consequences and values when it comes to, again, big constitutional questions. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. For our next episode, I'm going to bring you a frequently asked questions episode all about the Electoral College, contingent elections, and the Electoral Count Reform Act. So for now, I hope you enjoy this conversation that I had with Justice Breyer. Justice Breyer, I want to begin this conversation with something that I was able to ask you just a few moments ago, because I said, I think this is something that Americans fundamentally don't understand about the current court. People think the court has a supermajority that's conservative. They were appointed by Republican presidents. And so they're always going to come out in a way that will benefit Republican lawmakers. And I don't agree with that. My sense, reading your nonverbal cues, is that you don't agree with that. And I'm hoping that you can help us understand why legal analysis is different than political thought.
Well, I don't know how long you go. First, I want to thank you for inviting me here. And you have to remember that I grew up in San Francisco a long time ago. And what Nino Scalia and I would often discuss at lunch were old-time radio shows. That's what we knew. Where is Grauman's Chinese Theater, by the way? And how I have a cousin who wrote scripts for the movies. Could she get her fingerprints or her footprints in the cement outside Grauman's Chinese Theater? And I come down here and I think, where is Tom Mix and the Lone Ranger and all those programs I used to listen to? And we discuss them and we try to see which of the two of us could think of the commercial sponsors. Our example, Mr. District Attorney, brought to you by iPana and Truchet, the beforehand lotion. You see, we used to get on pretty well, as long as we stayed on that subject. No, but we did. People get on well. I've never heard a voice raised in conference. It's no shouting, no screaming. People are polite. They don't say rude things about each other there, not even as a joke. When you go around the table, it's serious and it is professional. And that's what I've seen. But you're asking about politics. Should I explain first the kind of cases that we take?
That would be great.
Yeah, I don't have to. But it's I use this example because it's such a good example of what appeals court judges do. Now, don't leave after I explain it. But the point is, I read it in a French newspaper, and there was a high school teacher who was traveling from Nantes to Paris with 20 live snails in the train, okay, in a basket. So the conductor comes up and he says, by the way, when I use this example, I'm normally talking to seventh grade students in high school or junior middle school or whatever. So I say, the conductor comes up. By the way, they're hard to talk to because they're looking out the window most of the time you're talking to them. But nonetheless, I say, the conductor comes up, looks at the basket, and he says, 20 live snails, hmm? He says, have you got a ticket for the snails? The teacher says, what are you talking about? You have a ticket for the snails? He says, read the fare book. It says no animals on the train unless they're in a basket and you have a ticket for them, half fare. So he says, but they're not talking about snails. They're talking about dogs and cats or maybe a rabbit. I'm talking about fleas, you think? Fleas, mosquitoes? I mean, the snail, that's ridiculous. So I say to the class, well, does he have to pay a fare or not? That's fabulous. I don't have to say another word. Half of them say, a snail's an animal, isn't he? A snail's an animal. And the other half say, but they don't mean that kind of animal. Well, it says animal. That's all I have to say the whole rest of the class. I say, when they talk for a while, I say, now you understand what appellate court judges do. Is the snail an animal? By the way, it might not be the word animal. It might be the freedom of speech. Or it might be the right to bear arms. But it's the same idea. Do those words apply here? Now, your question, isn't it all just politics? And I say, no, I've been a judge, I hate to tell you, for 40 years, 28 years on the Supreme Court. And I've not, it's not politics. What's politics? I mean, for a while, I worked for 4 years, I worked for Senator Kennedy. And I say, well, here's politics. Senator Kennedy's in the office. We get a phone call. Two phones ring. The mayor of Worcester is calling Senator Kennedy. The Secretary of Defense is calling Senator Kennedy. Which call will he take first? That's easy. Yeah, which is it? Worcester, of course. That's where the constituents are. That's what you're worried about. When you're going to be, are you going to be for this? Are you going to be, what are the newspapers going to say? What will your constituents think? What will the other party think? What will they say? That's politics. I said, will the Republicans come to the exec? I hope so. That's politics. Okay? Do I see politics? No. Well, aren't people appointed on the bench? Yes. Yes, every political group in the country has a favorite to be appointed to the Supreme Court. But while that group is appointing someone on the basis of politics or getting the president to do so, what they're thinking is that the judge has an approach towards certain issues that will lead to results that we like. The judge doesn't think it's politics. Now, what does it think? What is it in the court that people, I think, should, if they want to understand this, I think they have to be pretty precise. One, judges do think, they do take different approaches. Some of them, say like me, are more interested in what was the purpose of this particular set of words? What was the purpose of this constitutional phrase? What are the consequences of coming out this way rather than that way in respect to purpose? What are the values that this particular thing reflects one way or the other way, you see? But they have, or some say you should be more literal so that you do not substitute what you think is good for the law. Those are the textualists. But they think it through. They have different approaches. And those approaches, being different, are sometimes confused with what I just talked about with Senator Kennedy. That's one. I'm sorry, the long answer. But two, maybe they're political scientists. The political scientists have views about the United States of America. They're not politics. They're a little hard to understand sometimes. A little abstract. All those professors, political science professors. But by the time you're a certain age, you have views. And three, where do those views come from? In part, they come from, well, who are you? Who am I? I was born in San Francisco. Forget the rivalry. San Francisco, yes. My family's from there. I went to Lowell High School, a public school. I went to Stanford. I've lived the life I've lived. And you too, by the time you're in your 40s or 50s or 60s or whatever, you do have or will have views. Views about what? Well, what is this country about? How does the country work? How should it work? What is this Constitution, this document, which I still have in my pocket? What's it about? And what are the important values that are there? You'll have views. You will have views. And although you try to push them off to the side, because you try as hard as you can, but you can't jump out of your own skin. And I used to think, isn't it a pity that all the members of the Supreme Court don't agree with me, who is so reasonable? And after a time, I began to understand it's a big country, 330 million people. And it isn't such a terrible thing if different judges are appointed by different presidents and they tend to have who they are is somewhat different. That's not politics. That's your view of this country, or your view of the law, or your view of this document, etc. You say? Or there are other things, too. Paul Freund, who was a great professor at Harvard, constitutional law, he said, and think about this one, he said in respect to the judiciary and politics, he said, no judge is moved by or decides a case according to the temperature of the day. But every judge understands and is affected by the climate of the era. Yeah, that's a little hard to understand. I agree with you. It's obscure. That's perfect. But you see the point. You see the point. That tracks my experience pretty much. And then sometimes there's really a political decision. I think the miscegenation decision, the first one to come to the court, was political. What were they deciding? Don't take the case, said Frankfurter. You see what is happening. What is happening is the country is not enforcing Brown versus Board as they should. And nobody helped the court at the beginning. Nobody. And that we've got to put that first. And we decide the miscegenation case. Now we're going to say it's unconstitutional to have a law against interracial marriage. And then the South will never do it because they're all worried about that. Okay, so they waited a few years. They took the case later. Was postponing that case political? Yes. Was it for what purpose? So that they could get enforced Brown versus Board, demanding an end to segregation in the South. Not terrible. And the sixth thing is this. I read it in a biography of the Taft Court, a good book written by Robert Post, who was dean at Yale. And he says, he writes a letter to Sutherland. And he says, I hope, of course, that the new appointments to the court will be people who are good at law, because it is, after all, a legal job. But I also hope, he said, that they know something about the higher politics. Huh. Well, what's that? What's that? And I have to admit that being a member of the Supreme Court is different from being a member of a lower court. I tried both. I've done both. It is different. It is different because in the back of your mind, you cannot erase the fact that this is one of the three major institutions of government that the Constitution sets up for the United States. And does politics enter into a decision because of that? Keep it away. Can you say never pay attention? A little hard to say. So if someone can find a good definition, maybe you can, of what does he mean by the higher politics? And when does that occur? And when should you really pay attention to that? And when shouldn't you? And those are all unanswered questions. So I think by the time you understand the person who's saying, oh, it's all politics, that's such a vast oversimplification that I didn't say never wrong. I said it's an amazingly vast oversimplification. So by the time you go through those six things, I think you have a way of trying to explain it to yourself or understand it. See what a good question that was? It has me going forever.
Well, I feel like you served up a question to me about original jurisdiction and snail disputes, but I want to move past it for a minute because that's a great explanation. And I think for a lot of people, the law can feel removed in the sense that you just gave this great explanation of how what happens in the political sphere is different from what happens in a courtroom. And the book is, in my view, kind of a plea, an argument for this is how we should be judging. It should be pragmatism. Start with the text. We all start with the text. But also look at the purpose, also look at consequences, also look at values. The beginning and end isn't the text. And I want to tonight talk about some of the cases where you think they would have come out differently if the majority of the court had espoused your approach. And I'm wondering if outside of maybe Dobbs and Bruin that I want to get into tonight, are there places where you can say to an average American, this is why your life would be different if the majority of federal judges espouse pragmatism, as opposed to, I think you described it as kind of a beast from the Blue Lagoon textualism.
Well, pragmatism is a word that the publisher made up to put on this because it's too long, what I actually think. But what I mean it to cover is, look, of course you read the text. If the word in the text is vegetable, that does not mean a fish. Definitely does not. Not tempted to say it's a fish. It is not a fish, okay? I got that. But with most cases in the Supreme Court, we've taken a case because the lower courts have come to different conclusions on the same question of federal law. That isn't many. There are probably about 8,000 that ask us to take the case in a year, and we take about 60 or 70 or 80. That's because real differences are small. But that also means that when you get the case in front of you, it can be anything in the world, and it's tough. Because why did they reach different conclusions if it was so easy? And we could have a case that's people think is tremendously important in terms of their lives, or a case that only affects a few people. For example, we had a case where the question was, what does this comma in certain section of the Internal Revenue Code mean? Does it mean that the next word, which was four, should be read as a which or a that? We had a case sort of like that. I liked it. Nobody else did. But you see, or we could have Guantanamo. You can have and probably, 40% or so of our cases are unanimous. It certainly used to be that way. And what used to be the 5-4 were probably 18-20%. Like I counted them one year, maybe 15%. It depends on the year. But I saw that there were 18 cases that were 5-4. And there were 12 of those were not what you might call in the press the usual suspects. They weren't conservatives, liberals, as the press liberals labels them. So I thought 12 out of 18 were not. And then I thought probably, though I can't prove it, probably each time one of those cases came down, the press writes, well, in an unusual combination. I said, how could it be unusual? That was 12 out of 18. You know, all right, regardless. They're not going to write about the 40%, 50%, 60% that are not quite the comma case, but they're close. And so what's going on now? What's going on now is, for a variety of reasons, which I'll spare you, this thing called textualism sweeping the country. I say it's a tidal wave. Just read the text. Read the text and a few other things that are semantic is the word they like. They like semantics.
But it's so appealing to just read the text and have a definitive answer.
Of course it's appealing. They make four promises. Absolute. One, we promise this will be simple. Two, because you just read the text, and well, you see, it'll be fair because it'll be the same across the country, the result, in all the courts. Three, they say it'll help Congress. They know what'll happen. And four, which is the most important promise, is they say these judges will no longer be able to substitute what they think is good for the law. Congress should decide what's good. We should decide the law. Got those four promises? I listen to them. I think, hey, you have a good point. And if I hadn't had to live that for a while, I might still think so. I don't think so. Why? Well, so simple. Now, that's what you want. The example that I like to use is one of the simplest textualist cases we ever had. You probably, some of you know, that if you have a child who's handicapped, the school board has to have a special teaching program to adjust to the child, to help the child. And if you, the parent, think, well, the school board isn't doing a very good job, you can bring a lawsuit. And if you win, the statute says you can recover your, and this was the key word, costs. Okay? So we had a case. The mother had brought a case. Her child was handicapped, and she won. The school board had to do a better job. And see, she wanted her costs. And she wanted included $29,000 cost for an educational expert. Well, does the word costs include the cost of an educational expert? Or is it just legal costs like the lawyer, or maybe just the court costs? Which is it? So I say, well, okay, let's try the textualist system. I'll read it. It says, oh, I got it. It says costs. I'll read it carefully. Costs. I'll read it again. Cost, cost, cost. Okay, got it. I see. No, you're not going to get an answer. And I think I dissented in that case, and I thought we ought to look to what the report in the Senate said was their purpose. I thought we should look to what the conference committee said was their purpose. And I looked at the purpose and I thought it included, and the consequences included, the educational expert. Well, I think there is a case, quite simple. And the others are much worse, I tell you, they're harder. Where don't just read the text. If do a lot of other things. And that's fair, simple, not simple. I mean, there are very few cases that you can just get it from the text. If it's so easy to read the text and get the answer, why is it in the Supreme Court? I'm saying, and that's so that goes on for about 200 pages of the story.
It's 260. I read it a few times.
All right,
So I would like to get into another one of the cases that you highlight in the book, because I think it is an example of why textualism fails. And I'm thinking about the Bruin case that I mentioned a few moments ago, this 2022 case that deals with the Second Amendment and interpretation of the Second Amendment. I'm going to paraphrase the New York law that essentially said to people, if you want a concealed carry permit in public, you need a really good reason. And I'm being very broad about this. And interpreting the Second Amendment, the majority of the court said, no, that statute violates the individual right. And I think that we are about to find out in a few weeks, maybe how far the Bruin standard or test will go. But I'm wondering if you could explain why that was one of the examples in the book of where the promises of textualism fail. And then I want to talk about a little bit why pragmatism would give the lawmakers more flexibility in a modern era.
Well, with Bruin, they did. There were only seven states that had laws like New York, so they thought they were making a huge change. But it does say, go back and look and see. That's originalism, it's called. They have another word for that one with the Constitution, because you're supposed to. And Nino Scalia and I used to debate these things, but publicly. And the go back and look and see what the words meant at the time they were written to a reasonable person at that time. I say, that sounds okay. Now, is it? Is it okay? When it's a major point, or when it's a major, is it okay? Go back and look. It seemed to me, and we put this in the dissent, and Kagan, well, we all three of us wrote the dissent, but regardless, there seemed to be, and this is not a bad point, but it's not the main point. At the time that they wrote the 14th Amendment, which was what they were looking at, or the Second Amendment, which was what they were looking at, there seemed to be people missing from the political context. About half the country seemed not to be there in the political world. Maybe a few more than half, because there were slaves too. And no women, no slaves, etc. So be careful of when you look back to see what a reasonable person, but you can go beyond that. I said, well, okay, you're a historian. The majority, you're a historian. They know what was allowed and what was forbidden and what's analogous then to what's analogous now. You're going to do that and look and see. And so I looked, don't tell anyone this, but I looked into Wikipedia. I did. And I saw, what weapons did they have, for example, in the Hundred Years' War? So I wrote them in the opinion, a few of them. I said, what is a steel ladder? What is a, what were some of the other ones? Oh, a Haldabard. That's a good one.
Of course.
A Haldabard. What weapon today is analogous to a Haldabard? And I said, I don't know. And what about Asian fire? You throw it over the walls of the sea and the whole town catches fire or maybe something. So I said, what is that analogous to artillery? I mean, I don't know, but the judges are not great historians. And to ask them to go back, you'll get answers in the briefs, but these are the law, the associates in the law firm. Maybe they know what a Haldabard is, or a steel ladder. I thought a steel ladder is a sort of good one. I didn't know quite what that was at all. But that's one problem. That's number two, actually. And the third problem, which was the most relevant here, is remember that fourth promise, which has the greatest appeal. The judges will no longer be able to substitute what they think is good for what is the law. Okay, I got the promise. I see, that's the promise. And you think the textualism or the originalism is going to prevent them from doing that. Yeah, that's what we think, right? That's what they say. That's what Nino says. And they say, okay. I say, good. How did you decide to overrule Roe versus Wade? I was in dissent in that, so perhaps I feel a little strongly about it. But how did you decide to do that? Was it because Roe versus Wade and Casey v. Polino, because they weren't textualist decisions? Is that why you overruled them? I know what they're going to say to that. They have to say no. Because if that's the reason they overruled them, no case is safe. I mean, this textualism, originalism didn't come about till the 21st century, really. And so you're going to have the whole U.S. reports, shelf and shelf and shelf of U.S. reports. They're all out the window. No, of course they'll say no. That isn't the reason. Okay, I say, what is the reason? They'll say, well, the reason is what I said in the opinion, the majority. The reason is we think it was egregiously wrong, seriously wrong, very, very, very wrong. So I said, now I understand. You're going to go back and overrule, possibly, those cases that you think were really wrong. I see. And that's going to stop you from substituting what you think subjectively is right or wrong for the law. Now I think they're stuck. At least I couldn't find an answer to that, but maybe somebody will find an answer to that. And what it seems to me that does is say goodbye to the fourth promise, because they're in the same boat, exactly the same boat. A judge shouldn't substitute his views of what's good for the law, but the law requires you quite often to go and look into things that are basic in the United States, and that's different from saying what you subjectively think is good. People say, well, I do that? Just say what I subject. I've decided dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of death cases where I just let it pass. And I wrote an opinion which might suggest to a reader that I didn't think the death penalty was a great thing. Okay? But of course, in those dozens of cases, I go along with what the law is. And I think that's true of probably every judge or virtually every judge. Because if you want to go and not try to follow the law, what are you doing being a judge? I mean, what are you doing? There are other better paid positions. Please, the interest of this. Maybe I'll say that too. I was told by a president this. And it's so true. And it's both a cause for pessimism, it's a cause for optimism, really. He said, the applause dies away pretty fast. And you will see that you are left with the job, and you better like it. And I'm there for 2 years, and some kind of a reception, and the reception, I don't know, I go in there, a young lawyer comes up and he says, Justice Breyer, we love your opinions. We think they're so good. Would you ever sign my program? I say, sure. I'll sign his program. All right. He turns to his friend as he walks away, and he turns to his friend and he says, that makes four. You see? You see what it is? I understand. I understand. They will all know. They will all see. Sometimes what Justice William O. Douglas said, he said it takes 5 years. Souter said it takes 3 years. Mm-hmm. That's quick. But you adjust slowly, but surely. And somebody who thinks they're going to have applause from one group or the other is sorely mistaken. It will not be consistent. They'll learn that over time. You are left with the job, and the job is a very interesting job and very worthwhile, and you have to give. You have to give your all to every case, including the comma, because that means quite a lot to somebody. So I say it's like a doctor. A doctor doesn't take a patient who has a disease that he's seen 1,000 times and just say, I'm not going to pay attention because he's seen it 1,000. That isn't how a doctor works, and that isn't how a judge works either. I mean, you know, I can't guarantee every doctor and I can't guarantee every judge. But nonetheless, the job is you pay attention and you do your best. And that's just about what it is. For the first 2 or 3 or 4 years, you sit there frightened to death. How do I know I really could do this? How do I know? And then after a while, you say, well, you can only do your best. And it is something that absorbs you. And it is something that you just have to pay attention. So that's a cause for optimism.
So you're persuading me that there's something to this whole pragmatism concept that your publisher thought about, in the sense that I'm persuaded in hearing you talk about Bruin and Dobbs that there's some problem in having justices be historians, that there's something fundamentally regressive about textualism and originalism because they tend to not include, as you mentioned, at least half of the population, that there's some real issues, as you mentioned, with stare decisis and trying to figure out how we're going to exercise discretion without exercising discretion, because that's not the thing we're supposed to do. And so I think you make a great case here. I'm wondering if you are surprised that this is the book that you felt you had to write, in the sense that, are you surprised that, you know, maybe it was flipped, maybe it wasn't. We have justices on the maybe left side of the court saying, well, we're all textualists now. Are you surprised that this caught hold, given that you've pointed out, I think, so many of the very real failings of an originalist or textualist approach?
It was picked up. I don't know. I think, why did I write this book? In part, I think I wrote it because it's partly my own personality, which isn't necessarily the world's greatest, but nonetheless. Look, but it works in the court pretty well. Lincoln said this in 1848. He said, speaking to a temperance society, he says, if you want to get somewhere, in public life, certainly, but maybe in private life too, you have to persuade people. And if you want to persuade someone, you have to talk to them. And if you talk to them and try to persuade them, the first thing, says Lincoln, you must persuade them of is that you are their sincere friend. Mm-hmm. I don't think it does good to go around shouting at people whom you really disagree with. My own approach is, when I really disagree with the majority and I'm writing a dissent, I try to write it in a way that a child of two would have to think I was right. Well, that's just it. And so what I've written in Bruin, what I've written in Dobbs, you can try it out with a child of two. I don't know too well. You see the point. You see the point. And so I fear that this is taking over. I don't think it is a sound way to adopt generally for opinions. I think, of course, you read the text, but the text very often doesn't answer the question. When I go back to John Marshall, I didn't invent this. Read McCulloch versus Maryland. The Bank of the United States. Can Congress pass a law establishing a Bank of the United States? That's a constitutional question in McCulloch. And Marshall says, well, you can read this document. You know how many times it mentions the word bank? Correct.
I teach
zero. Zero. Okay? And he says, there are other words. There are other general words you're going to use. And you have to decide what they mean. And they have to last a long time. And that's when he says, it is a constitution we are expounding. And those are the words that are engraved around the basement of the lower floor of the Supreme Court. And so, of course, where in an appropriate case, I have to say all these things are in an appropriate case, you're going to look to see, what about the values of this document? And to me, and I think to many, most people probably, you see democracy, a protection of basic human rights, separation of powers, degree of equality, rule of law, and there are others. But that runs through this document, and so will you sometimes look to see if this statute is consistent with that? Of course you will. I think of course you will. And when you're interpreting phrases of the Constitution, will you see if this interpretation, rather than that interpretation, assuming the language allows it, is more consistent with this part, with these basic values? I think the answer is, of course. I think that was what Marshall was talking about in McCulloch. I think that Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., that's what he's talking about. That's what Cardoza was talking about. That's what Brandeis was talking about. That's what Learned Hand was talking about. That's what the people whom I was taught in law school to admire and whom I do admire, that's what they're talking about. I didn't make this up. And it is sort of traditional, is what I think. And when I took courses of legal philosophy, Hart and Sachs and so forth, they would say, and I that the whole point of law in general in the United States, not every case, but overall in general, it is to try to help these 330 million people, all of whom think something different. And I promise, my mother used to say, there's no view so crazy there isn't somebody in this country who doesn't hold it. But they have to live together. And you, the law should help them live together in peace and productively. And if it's working well, maybe it will. Not always. But there is a goal out there. And there is a general goal. And the theories or the approaches, or you can go back to 1584 in Montaigne. He said, life is so complicated, no set of laws can replicate it. So be careful of having too detailed a set of laws. That was his conclusion. He said, have standards, have approaches, have generalities sometimes. Have a driving law that says, he didn't say this, but it's the same idea. It used to be in California, you couldn't drive faster than was safe, something like that. They changed it to make it work as it gets into rules and stuff. I think they changed it. My son, who now lives here, said, yeah, they changed it. But anyway, the idea is still there. And it's an old idea. It's an old idea that life has its twists and turns. And so does that's true in general, and it's true for specific individuals always. So be careful of being too rigid. Be careful of being too literal. You cannot substitute just everything you think is good. Absolutely not. But be careful of this literalism. And so that's where I take this from. And I thought when you just said somebody, I think she said it as a joke, but maybe not. I don't know. We're all textualists now. I am not a textualist. And I do not think it will help. And but other people can disagree. So why do I write this? I want to persuade them. I want to persuade them. That's why I write it. And I hope I will.
So I noticed that you're getting applause now for something that I think makes a lot of sense. And you talked about the law working for 330 million people. And there are a lot of people out there who don't currently applaud Supreme Court justices and have faith in them. And we talked a little bit before about how there's this enormous kind of political push of, well, we know how we can solve the problems of the Supreme Court. Let's just have a mandatory ethics code. And let's just have this person from behind the curtain. Let's have the Wizard of Oz who oversees this ethics code. And I'm hoping that you can talk to us a little bit about maybe the problems with, let's just have a mandatory ethics code and that will solve the issues.
Ethics you're talking about.
Yes.
Well, it's one, every judge is in favor of ethics. Two, you cannot have a judicial system unless judges behave ethically. There's no doubt about that. All right. Three, which isn't always written, there are 7 volumes for federal judges of ethics. Now, whether you call them mandatory or not is the same for all these federal judges, whether the district court, court of appeals, whatever they are. But I had them. If there was like somebody comes up and says, recuse yourself, I will look it up in the 7 volumes. And there's a lot written there. But suppose I can't find the answer. Then what I would do is I call an ethics expert. They're all in every law school in the country. There's an ethics expert. Okay. And some of them pretty good. And then I just happen to think of one I won't mention, but I forget it. But yeah, right. They are. But that is how it is with every field, I promise. Okay, forget that. I'm just getting myself into trouble. but the point is, in the Supreme Court, unlike the district courts, you have to be careful, be sure to sit, unless there is an obligation not to. You have an obligation to sit, as well as an obligation not to sit. When you're in the Court of Appeals or a district court, you can err on the side of recusing yourself. Why? Because they can find another judge. In the Supreme Court, you can't. And that means that, far be it from me to criticize anyone in the legal profession. But it is conceivable that a lawyer might sometimes think he can change the result in the case by getting a particular judge recused. So be careful. And when Nino had a tough issue, he comes in and we discuss it. And he discusses it in conference. And everybody has some system like that. Now you say, well, what would it be the harm of having an inspector general who could tell a judge? This would be the harm. And it's tough. And there's no answer to it that I can find. There's no answer either way. Should a judge, you want a judge who pays attention to public opinion? Suppose your friend is the least popular person in the United States and he gets involved in a criminal trial. You want the judge to be responsible and looking to public opinion? Certainly not. But if the judges never pay any attention to anybody else, but, that isn't going to quite work either. Now do you see the virtue of Paul Freund's remark? That in terms of politics, not the temperature of the day, no judge. But the climate of the era? Now do you see why it's difficult? It's called judicial independence. And for any federal judge, what you see in that document is if a judge behaves badly, there is one group that absolutely can control him, and that is the Senate. They could impeach him. And anyone who thinks of behaving badly can write a letter. And any chief judge or any member of a court can write a letter about somebody else. They could. They could in any court. Well, is that good enough? I don't know. I'll tell you why it's a conundrum. It's a conundrum is what it is. No doubt about ethics. No doubt about there being a system for each judge. No doubt about trying to be ethical. Special situation in the Supreme Court in respect to recusals, because you have a duty to sit. But what is this independence? What is it? And the thing I like to remind, you didn't hear it. I heard it. Tony Kennedy, my colleague. We had a bunch of Russian judges just after the Iron Curtain fell. They came to the court, and we were having dinner, and Tony was talking to them about judicial independence, and what he said made a big mark on me. He said, judicial independence? He said, you're really going to be independent? No more telephone justice? Maybe it didn't work out for them. But I'll tell you something he said about judicial independence. Do you think anybody will know if you're not being independent? Do you think anybody will know if you don't really pay attention to the record, honestly? Do you think anybody will know if you're playing to the newspapers? Probably not. The lawyer who wins, of course, will think you're right. The lawyer who loses will think you're a real idiot. He won't say that, but he'll think you're an idiot. Not paying attention? Not really trying to do what's right? There's only one person who will know. And the person who will know in a difficult case, that's you. There's nobody else. You will know whether you've been honest, whether you've been true to the record, whether you have not been playing to anybody, but you're trying to reach the decision that the law demands. You'll know. And other judges can understand what, in difficult cases, in really difficult cases, they can understand what you're going through. But they won't know whether you were right or whether you were wrong, whether you were really independent or whether you were not. But you'll know. And you better be independent. You better be independent because if you don't want to decide the case, honestly, I say take another job. That's all you can say. Now, that's who I am. I'm speaking what I think, and I'm saying I'm stuck on this. So you're going to have to figure it out. But that's where I am in terms of independence. I think it couldn't be more important. Could not be more important. And how do you get there? And what do you have to do to maintain it? You tell me. And it's a tough question. And it's right there in many, many, many cases.
Well, one way that we try and promote judicial independence is lifetime appointments.
That's right.
And the idea, which I think makes a lot of sense, is make a decision, not because it's going to be popular in the next election, but make a decision because it's the, according to your approach of judicial philosophy, it's the right decision or it's a sound decision. But an ethics code is not the only reform that is out there that is talked about. And I know that you've talked about this as well, but there are other Supreme Court reforms where there's now, I think, in part because of the historically low public opinion polls surrounding the Supreme Court, that people are talking about term limits, staggered terms. Are these ideas that not only might you think about, but might this give a chance to say?
Yeah, it might be fine. I was saying that if you had you'd have to have a long term, 20 years, I don't know, 18 years, long term, because you don't want somebody thinking, sitting on that court and thinking about what his next job is going to be. Okay. So it has to be a long term. That would have made my life easier. She wouldn't have to worry, am I going to step down this year or the next year or whatever year? You wouldn't have to worry about that. And it's an agonizing decision for everybody who reaches retirement age. And you have to figure out when and what's the right time. You're never going to get it quite right. But that's a part of human life. All right. So if they had, like most countries have, they have a age limit. Should be a long term. I don't think an age limit would hurt, but maybe you'd need an amendment. I don't know. I haven't looked into it that much. I don't know. And there are a number of ideas floating around. Look into them.
So one of the things you can do is change the composition of the court, term limits, staggered terms. But one thing, getting back to our current court and getting back to your arguments.
Well, normally when people have changed things, including they do it for the next group.
Right. Maybe one of the ways that we might see a change towards more pragmatism, I'm wondering about your optimism towards the current court, is what do you think the chances are? We've seen this in the past, Justice Souter, Justice Stevens, where once people are appointed, their views tend to shift.
Yeah, I mean, not always, sometimes. And Byron White used to say with every new appointment, it's a new court because the dynamic is somewhat different. That's true. And people over time, as I said, they become used to understanding. Maybe they begin after a while, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, to think there is no single way. There is no single magic formula that is going to decide all these cases. And I think this might help a little bit, this much. In sort of moving people just a little bit. And you're never going to have, if people are, you know, if their background is such that they're very conservative or they're very liberal or whatever, you probably won't change them completely, but you'll get sort of what you should we call it, a kind of loosening of the fabric that they thought was going to determine all these cases. And I think you might see that after a while. I mean, I don't know.
One of the things that I found when thinking about will the court shift and in reading your book and that I found most persuasive is the idea that this form of constitutional interpretation and this form of interpretation of statutes, this originalism, this textualism, that it actually fundamentally undermines the purposes behind our Constitution. You've talked a little bit about this already, but the idea that it doesn't serve the Constitution well not to give it, and I know you've written other books about this as well, but to give it some breathing room to allow for there to be modern interpretation, for instance.
I obviously can agree with that, but most of these are matters of degree. Look, Nino Scalia and I used to have public debates, and we'd go to, for example, I remember we went to Lubbock, Texas. Well, there were big, it was a big crowd of the college students there, and we were in the football field. I think they must have thought there was going to be a football game or something, but because there were quite a few people, and they didn't know the Supreme Court, they hadn't seen Supreme Court justices, which is why we went there. And they would see from our discussion that we're good friends, but that we have different views. And he would say, I think it's a great boy. I'd say, you know, George Washington, we're talking about, George Washington didn't know about the internet. And Nino would say, I knew that. And he'd say, he'd say, well, but it's really like the two campers. So I'd say, what do you mean the two campers? And he'd say, I'd heard that joke many times, he'd say, you know, one of the campers is putting on running shoes, and the other says, why are you putting on running shoes? And he says, because there's a bear in the camp. There's a bear. You can't outrun a bear. He says, yeah, but I can outrun you. Yeah. So then when we got finished the jokes, he would say that the problem with the way you interpret things, the problem with your approach, Stephen, is that it's too complicated. And you're going to find you're the only one who can do it. No, I said, I don't think, well, it's too complicated. I said, yes, that may be true. It is complicated. And it does require judgment. And you may be wrong. But I said, the trouble with your approach, which is to read these things literally, is that you'll get a constitution nobody wants. Yeah. And so who's right in that? And I said, the truth is we don't know. I suspect I'm right. He suspects he's right. Okay? And that's true of many cases too. Many, not all, but many. You don't know how this will work out over time. You can make estimates, you can do your best, but it's for a long time. And therefore, the time horizon of a Supreme Court justice is quite different from a member of Congress. Harold Wilson said once, a day is a long time in politics. But that's not what we're about. And so we know perfectly well, the judges on the Supreme Court all know, that what they write there might, it might, no guarantee, but it might last for a long time. And if it does, it will be some future, 20, 30, I don't know how many years from now. And they will say whether this worked out well or worked out badly. So we won't know. So all we can do is the best we can do. And that's how people think. And it means it's going to take a few months to decide a case anyway. A few weeks, certainly. And often a few months. It's not the time horizon of a person in politics. And that's just what it is.
So I like the stories about you and Justice Scalia arguing. And I think it, because it shows that you respect each other, that you're friends and you have a difference of opinion when it comes to these hugely consequential issues. But I also think it pulls back the curtain a little bit to the top of a branch that is not as transparent for plenty of good reasons as the other branches. And so I'm wondering if, as we're concluding our conversation, if you could tell us a little bit about something I asked you before, but maybe your most and least favorite days on the court.
My most favorite days was when Sandra O'Connor somehow got a copy of the movie Red River, and she showed it in a movie theater right next to it and had a barbecue at the same time. So that was a very good day. My least favorite is when I unfortunately, shall I admit, my one thing I do that probably isn't such a good thing, is I say...
We're not taping, don't worry.
Okay. The question, that's all right, you can't, I don't care. But the questions that I would ask, I never, rarely figured a question I was going to ask in oral argument. The oral argument is for the judges to ask questions. A good question is a question where I don't know the answer. I think the lawyer knows more about it than I do. And I think I might get an answer out of him that will help me decide the case. And some of the justices think that's the null set. But nonetheless, that's what you're trying for. And sometimes you ask a question to show the other colleagues, where you're coming from. And that sometimes helps. And sometimes you ask a question because you think it's funny. Don't do it. It was a huge mistake. And I cannot say I've never given into that temptation. But it's not a good idea. But since I don't prepare the question, rarely, you don't know what's going to come into my head. And who doesn't know? I don't know. Okay. So we had in law school, in Lon Fuller's class, a philosophical example. He was jurisprudence. And he says, there's a sign in the park saying no vehicles. And the question is, the sign no vehicles in the park, does that apply to a Jeep used as a war memorial? Okay, got that? Okay, that was the puzzle we had to, okay. So I remembered that, but I didn't quite get it right. So the lawyer, honestly, the situation was just called for that example. But I couldn't quite remember the example, but I didn't realize I couldn't remember the example until I was halfway through. So I said, suppose you're at the park and there's a sign and it says, and I couldn't remember the sign. So I said, suppose it says no animals in the park. And so the lawyer stood there and he said, yes. And so I said, then I was really stuck because I couldn't think of what. So I said, would that mean you couldn't bring in your pet oyster? So the lawyer said, what? So Rehnquist looked over and he said, did you have a pet oyster? So at that point, I thought I should keep quiet.
This gives me optimism about the court, Justice Breyer.
We have some time for audience questions that were sent in. Jeremy, a senior high school student, asks, a lot has been said recently about which justices should recuse themselves from this case or that. So let me ask you the question a little differently. Outside of obvious recusals for prior work and stock holdings, etc., under what circumstances should a justice recuse himself or herself? What activity by a spouse might warrant a recusal?
Well, I'm not going to go into that because I'm not really talking about individuals. I'm talking about the institution. And there are those seven volumes and they're the various experts. And you want it. Those are the people you should consult, but you're a high school student. So I think instead I'll use what you say as an excuse to say, well, I'm somewhat optimistic about the United States of America. And really it's because when I have the chance, I like talking to high school students. And you tell me if this is true, that I think you're going to talk to high school students. The first thing you have to do is get their attention, which is not that easy always. And, I was talking about the seventh grade before, but you consider the ninth grade or the 10th or whatever, the 11th, the 12th, when you're in the 12th. All right. So at some point, I know they're going to say, what can we do with this divided country? And I say, well, my friends, you're the ones who are going to have to decide that. I can't tell you. It's your country. And it is now your constitution and your country, and you're going to have to figure it out. But I can tell you this. I can tell you, as I say often at your graduation or college graduation, my hope for you, I hope you find someone to love. I hope you find a good job. And I hope that you will participate in public life. Now, at least vote. But I can say more than that. Derek Bach said this in a very tough way in a book he wrote about education, and he said that Pericles, in his great funeral oration in Athens, talking about the virtues of the democracy of Athens, he said, among many other things, he said, what do we say in Athens of a person, of a man, who does not participate in public life? We do not say he is a man who minds his own business. We say he is a man who has no business here. Okay? So that's what I want you to do, because I know that this document won't work if you don't. All right? The school board, library commission, whatever you want. But at least vote. And I'll tell you, I'll pass on to you, I say, to them. Just like the senior here. I say, I'll pass on to you what Senator Kennedy told us when we worked on the staff where I worked for 4 years. Yeah, what? He said credit, he would say, is a weapon. Forget about trying to get credit for things. When you're trying to get something through or block something, whatever you're trying to do, if you're meeting opposition, the first thing you do is find, and Stan Stuart Mill said this, find an intelligent person who really thinks the opposite of what you think. And you go talk to him. Well, wait. Talk to him, but be careful. Don't talk too much. Listen. And if you listen long enough, they will say something that you really agree with. And as soon as they do, you say, what a good point you made. Okay, got it? And then let's see if we can work with that. And if you work with it, maybe you'll get somewhere. And if you get 30% of what you want, take it. Do not try to get 100%, which you will never get, and just because your followers want you to get 100%, they'll say you're a hero when you failed to get anything. Take the 30%. And then I saw him a lot when the press came in and they'd say he got something. He'd say, Senator Kennedy, you did such a good job. Don't thank me. Thank Orrin Hatch. Thank the Republican. He came up with the idea that allowed us to reach this agreement or whatever it was. Okay? And I say, he used to say, well, credit, if the thing works, there'll be plenty of credit to go around. And if it doesn't work, who wants the credit? No. What makes me optimistic is not necessarily what I've just said, but the attention I get from the seniors in high school or the juniors or the look in their eye when I say to them just what I said to you, because they're suddenly interested. They're suddenly thinking, maybe I could do some of that. They're suddenly thinking, maybe I do have something I could do that would help make this country work a little better. And it maybe it's my imagination, but I don't think it is. And if I think that's how they're thinking, I suddenly become a little bit more optimistic about the United States of America.
Susan asks, what does precedent mean to you? Several recent appointees made comments in their confirmation hearings about respecting precedent, but then decided otherwise. What gives?
Precedent, you can't overturn every case, right? Stare decisis is you follow cases. It's easy to follow ones you think are right, but I mean the rule of stare decisis is you follow the ones that are wrong. Even if they're wrong, you can't go back. The law has to be stable. It doesn't mean you never overturn a case. And if you never overturned a case, we wouldn't have had Brown versus Board. We'd still be in Plessy v. Ferguson. There'd be segregation. God only knows what. But it doesn't mean never. But it means there are kinds of situations where maybe you can overrule a case, but you get to go down that road too fast, too far, and the whole legal system is in trouble. And everybody understands that. Okay? So precedent has weight, but you're never going to say 100%, because you're going to look at it in some cases. Now, that's the best I can do.
Next question comes from Alan. Alan says, if you were writing the Constitution today, would you put an explicit presidential immunity clause, similar to what the founders did for members of Congress with speech and the debate clause? The fact that there is not one, is that significant to you?
That is an excellent question. But I'm afraid I'm going to answer that question, as it's currently before the court, the same way I answered the high school seniors question, which was also a good question. But no, I can't go into that. I could repeat about that.
The First Amendment begins with the phrase, Congress shall make no law. If the president unilaterally issued an executive order, in quotes, abridging the freedom of speech, please assume, Joseph here says, that this executive order would clearly violate the First Amendment if Congress passed it.
Yeah, I mean, it's well established. The executive branch, nor Congress, neither Congress nor the executive branch, nor the states, nor government officials can violate the First Amendment. That's well-established law. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
I hope not. I teach that in First Amendment law.
Yeah. The interesting thing I read about the First Amendment, can I go into the First Amendment for a second?
Sure.
Okay, look, this is interesting. Because I read this in Bert Newborn's book, and I think it's a very interesting point about the First Amendment. Look, Congress shall, it does say Congress, but it is established to all government. Through the 14th and so forth. I'll spare you that. But Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. All right. At the time they wrote this, if you want to think, a thinking person was probably, at least outwardly, a religious person. And they were arguing about religion in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. And so, but Newborn thought that that's probably a way of saying you have freedom of thought. Think what you want. The government cannot try to control what you think. Then it says, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Okay, so consider. First, you think. Think what you want. You do not have to express your thoughts, but you can. And if you want to say those parts of your thinking, not about the oyster, but about, you see, you think those parts of your thinking you want to express them. So first we think, and then we speak. And then it says, or abridging the freedom of the press. We think, we speak, and the press can disseminate that which they choose to disseminate across to other people who weren't there. And we're building a public opinion. Or the right of the people to assemble. To assemble? To do what? To consider, for example, the words that were spoken, the ideas, there's the marketplace of ideas. Or, and to petition the government for redress of grievances, i.e., public opinion. You see, we think, we speak, it's disseminated, we assemble, i.e. we discuss, public opinion is formed, and then where does it go? It goes to Congress so that Congress can consider the public opinion both ways, whatever it is, and can pass laws that are within the bounds or be affected by public opinion. So that is the view of the First Amendment, at least in important part, as a transmission belt. As a transmission belt of people's ideas, thoughts, controversies, etc., so that our laws can, through representation, be democratically established. I think that's a very important way of life. It's not the only thing in the First Amendment, but it is an important thing. And so, what? They should study it. And first thing to realize is it applies to all government officials. It applies to all government officials. It's perhaps first because it is so important in the way I just expressed, which wasn't me, it was Bert Newborn, expressed to maintaining this democracy.
And our final question for the evening, Steve asks, this shadow docket thing, good or bad?
Well, it took time. This is where you have new members. The shadow docket has become a popular way of referring to what every single court has. It's called an emergency docket. And so if you're in a lower court and the judge decides something and you're afraid he is going to let that take effect immediately rather than giving you a chance to appeal, you can go to the emergency dock of the next higher court, and you can say, please stop that from taking effect until I have a chance to argue it. And the other side can tell you why you shouldn't do that, whatever. And sometimes you will, like an execution is going to take place tomorrow, but maybe this particular individual, although he has been to the court before, he might have a new point. Maybe he has a good point. Well, you don't want that to become moot. You don't want to become execute. You want to execute him if he has a good legal point. And when, for most of the time I was there on the Supreme Court, it was about death penalty. Now, three things happened at once. One, you got three new appointments. You got COVID, which had for some people religious implications of the, you know, the vaccines and so forth. And you had an election. All these three things taking place, election cases. And so possibly there was a time necessary to adjust to the fact that the shadow docket does not normally decide the merits of a case. You're just going to wait, and now we'll get the briefs, and then we'll hear the oral argument, and then we will decide. And I think that, as I wrote in some dissents, that I thought they were deciding too much too fast on the shadow docket. And I think perhaps that's disappeared. I'm not positive, but I think gradually people have adjusted. And it's an emergency docket. You would know more about that than me.
Justice Breyer, I think this is where we thank you, not just for your book, but for your service.